I met Percy Duane Dubois, after a fashion, at his Indianola house. I'd come to collect his television and was explaining to his wife that they'd gone 3 months delinquent on their rent-to-own installments. He eased up behind me. I heard the Joyce complain, to offer commentary with a shovel. Lucky for me, it was a fireplace shovel, though uncommonly stout as that sort goes, and he swung it with force enough to lay me out on the linoleum. Since I'd enjoyed a sort of career in legitimate law enforcement, I'd met with occasion to get myself knocked on the head a time or three. I'd been dinged with assorted planking, a dinette chair, a brass shoe tree, had survived my share of semi-drunken glancing tire iron blows, and was once deafened for a week in Roanoke by a she-male named Varnella who caught me square on the ear with a handbag full of what proved to be shoplifted rice. So I was familiar with the abrupt iron oxide flavor of it all and the baleful overtures of gravity. I knew the barest of chances to mount a survey of the kitchen floor before selecting a spot and informing myself, I think I'll stretch out here. I don't believe I was ever altogether senseless. As him and the wife were wrangling about me, I could make out what they said. In what I preferred to believe at the time, a home economical impulse, she proposed they hack me up and pack me off to the woods in a sack. She was kicking me all the while she talked, poking me with her naked foot in a fashion that suggested I was exasperating clutter. "Let's think about the boy," he told her, and they contemplated together their son, who was sitting hard beside me in his grimy, fragrant diaper. The ammonia reek alone was probably keeping me awake. He was rolling a little plastic sedan up and down my shirt front while he burbled that way toddlers will and unfreighted himself of drool. The wheels tickled and left me helpless against the need to twitch and squirm, which earned me the occasional supplemental shovel tap. Up to this point, he could have gotten off with a month or two in the lockup, back payments on his TV, and a spot of contrition before a judge. But he saw fit to go the way his sort will, all white trash philosophical, and decided the world was stacked against him, and he'd never know much of a shake. He informed his wife there were higher-ups in the government in Jackson, most especially a fella he had crossed once on the Attorney General's crew, who were looking to put him in parchment any way that came to hand. So it hardly mattered what he did or how he went about it. "I can't come out on top." He said it with that air of wan self-pity that's peculiar to humans with Pall Malls behind their ears and homemade tattoos. Then he thumped me again and helped himself to my key ring and my wallet, and that was when his troubles got authentically underway. By sheer chance, I was driving a pristine 1969 Ranchero that my landlady had told me her dead husband, Gil, would have wanted me to drive. I'd never met Gil, but I'd seen a snapshot of him on her sideboard. It showed him wearing spotless coveralls and grimly armor-alling attire. Gil looked the sort who'd probably rather have made me the loan of his liver than endure me to wheel his Ranchero out into the fallen world. Sadly for him, his widow wasn't the sort to value a car, and worse still, the woman was a relentless insister by disposition. She had let off insisting I call her Pearl instead of Mrs. Jarvis, had insisted I park my Nova in her driveway instead of down by the curb. She routinely insisted her guidepost on me directly out of her post box and piecemeal items from Gil's wardrobe that never threatened to fit.